Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A little bit of Apple on the broadcast today. The politics of the American economy as well. And we're going to visit with our rancher out in Missouri. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 24th of April today. And we begin with the most important company in the world, Apple, of course. Okay, I kid, but not by too much. Apple's every move is scrutinized, analyzed, and second-guessed to within an inch of its life, which explains all the attention paid to its quarterly earnings report. Profits dropped for the first time in a decade, not at all what shareholders wanted to hear, having seen shares go from $700 a pop a couple of months ago to just over $400 today. So to make nice, Apple's going to pay out $11 billion in dividends this year and set aside $60 billion to buy back its stock to, the theory goes, bump up that share price a little bit. But, and here's the puzzler, why is the company, which famously has no debt and a whole pile of money just sitting there, going to borrow to do all that? Marketplace's Sally Herships starts us off.
Just how big is Apple's stash of cash?
$145 billion.
Steve Kaplan teaches finance at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business.
Why would a company with $145 billion just lying around borrow money?
Some of this cash is sitting offshore, and because of the complicated tax law we have, when they bring some of that money back into the United States, they pay an additional tax.
Kaplan says this is not just an Apple problem. American companies, including Microsoft, Google, and Dell, are estimated to have between $1.5 and $2 trillion of cash overseas. The government says it wants to lower corporate taxes, but these hoards are a stumbling block.
You know, on average, every dime, you know, there'll be a dime of every dollar that'll come home that'll be lost to U.S. taxes.
Jennifer Bluin teaches accounting at Wharton. That dime is the difference in what companies have already paid in overseas tax and what they'd have to pay in the U.S. In Apple's case, it may be more like a quarter or 30 cents for every dollar.
So you can look at Apple's financial statements and estimate what their foreign tax rate that's being paid on their earnings overseas, and it's at most maybe a couple percent.
The top corporate tax rate here is 35%. Which is why Apple may be more interested in borrowing money than transferring it from overseas. Interest rates are at all-time lows. This week, Nike borrowed $1 billion. It's paying bondholders less than 3% interest. And Apple is likely to get as good a rate, if not better. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Cooks can be temperamental. You see it on those cooking shows all the time. Now, students at one of the country's top cooking schools seem to have learned that lesson. They walked out of a class at the Culinary Institute of America yesterday over what they say are slipping standards. From the Education Desk, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
When was the last time you heard a college student demanding stricter enforcement of the dress code? That's one of the complaints of a group of students at the Culinary Institute of America. In the kitchen, student chefs wear the iconic crisp white jacket, kerchief, and, when appropriate, tall white toque. Students who go on for bachelor's degrees are expected to wear business casual.
They're showing up in Uggs and hoodies, and they're not tucking their shirts in, or they're wearing sneakers, or they're wearing shorts. Sometimes.
That's 20-year-old Zach Hoffman, one of the organizers of yesterday's walkout. He says students like that are degrading the value of a CIA degree. And part of the problem is the rise of celebrity chefs and food shows like this one.
I'm Anthony Bourdain. That's right. I write, I travel, I eat, and I'm hungry for more.
I think some of the students come in here thinking they're going to come out and be the next Anthony Bourdain or the next Kat Cora or the next Johnny Azumi, you know, have their TV shows, be rock stars.
A more likely reality is a pile of student debt and a tough job market. The student protesters also worry admission standards have been lowered. Incoming students used to need 6 months' experience in a professional kitchen. Now the school includes so-called front-of-the-house experience, like serving or bussing tables. Mark Erickson is provost of the Culinary Institute. He says as students' interests have expanded to include wine and research and development, it made sense to expand the requirement.
It's really just demonstrating that they understand the rigor that is expected of somebody in our industry. And that's satisfied in the front of the house just as it is in the back of the house.
Erickson admits the dress code could be better enforced. But what students like Zach Hoffman are worried about is whether they'll get the chance to wear those chef's whites once they graduate. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Bon appétit!
As for Wall Street today, oh, Julie, we missed you. As for Wall Street today, meh, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. At least 100 people are dead in the collapse of a garment factory in Bangladesh today. Nearly 1,000 more have been injured on the outskirts of the capital city, Dhaka. It's the second disaster at a garment factory there in less than 6 months. And a lot of those plants make clothes for Western companies, clothes that eventually wind up on store shelves in Europe and here in the States. The BBC's Ambarasan Ithirajan is at the site of the collapse. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Did this building actually just collapse, or is it true, as I've been reading, that there were reports yesterday that there had been cracks and that officials had been told to stay out of that building?
That's what local media reports have been saying, that there were reports of a crack, and one of the eyewitnesses also told a local daily that they were reporting cracks near the generator room and also in some of the pillars. Then this morning, this eight-story building where I'm just sitting outside this building, it just came crashing down, trapping hundreds of people inside. The officials here, they're not commenting on this newspaper reports about whether cracks had appeared or not, but what one of the ministers had already said, the building probably might have violated construction codes, and they are looking into this case.
Do you know what companies that the workshops in this building were making the garments for? Were they Western or European countries, do you know?
It's not still clear what are the Western brands this company or this clothing factory was making. This building housed a garments factory. And as you know, Bangladesh is one of the leading exporters of ready-to-wear clothes, mostly to the European Union and to the United States. And even last November, when a factory caught fire outside the capital, Dhaka, more than 110 people were killed. Later on, a trade union activist found labels of various Western retailers. So probably we will come to know about what were the Western brands or possibly the Western retailing brands which are produced in this factory. But it is too early to say at this point, because the authorities are now focusing on rescuing people and taking the injured people to the hospital.
You know, there's been some success in pressuring factories in China to raise their working standards, you know, Apple being the most successful case, actually. Is there any chance now that this second horrible disaster in 6 months will increase pressure on Bangladesh and American factories who build there to change their standards?
Yes, indeed, because Bangladesh has emerged as the second largest exporter of ready-made clothes after China. It exported nearly $20 billion worth of clothes last year. And the Western retailers are increasingly turning towards Bangladesh because the cost of production is increasing in countries like China. And so Bangladesh is emerging as a leading destination for retailers making cheap clothes. At this time, it has come. So it will put pressure on the Bangladeshi factory owners to improve safety standards.
These workers who were killed today in this collapse and the ones who were injured, do you know how much they might have made, say, per month in salary?
The workers, they earn on an average, the basic, the minimum wage for these workers is between $37 and $40 a month. But factory owners, they say most of the workers are skilled. This minimum wage is only for those who are starting the work. Within a few months, we increase the salary. And the salary goes up to $60 to $80 a month for most of the workers. But trade unions in Bangladesh, they say Bangladeshi workers are the lowest paid for this type of work in the world.
Ambarasan Ithirajan with the BBC just outside Dhaka, Bangladesh. Ambarasan, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much.
We're going to pause now for a little inside baseball, a bit of the political reality that often goes hand in hand with the American economy. Richard Cordray has been the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for the past 15 months or so, the key word there being acting. Cordray is a recess appointment, never confirmed by the Senate, and that is an issue now since the chairman of a key House committee isn't going to let Cordray testify because of it. So what, you ask? Well, here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to tell you why.
House Financial Services Committee Chairman Jeb Hensarling wrote Richard Cordray a letter this week. The Texas Republican says Cordray is barred from addressing his committee until he's confirmed by the Senate. Cordray has already testified on the Hill a bunch of times. He appeared before the Senate Banking Committee just yesterday.
Thank you, Senator, for the question.
People testifying on the Hill often look pained, like it's about as much fun as a root canal. So maybe Cordray should be happy that he won't have to go before Hensarling's committee? Or is this a serious challenge to the CFPB?
What you worry about is that there's a chilling effect.
Deepak Gupta is a former CFPB attorney, now in private practice. He's not worried about what he calls political posturing on Capitol Hill. But he says a recent court case has cast a cloud of legal uncertainty over the Bureau. In January, a federal appeals court said the appointment of another Obama administration official was unconstitutional because it was a recess appointment made while Congress wasn't in session. Richard Cordray was appointed the same way. Gupta says now it could be hard for the CFPB to enforce rules intended to protect consumers.
Anyone that's sued by the Bureau or threatened with an enforcement action has the option of raising the constitutionality of the director's appointment.
Already, a Texas bank is suing CFPB over just that issue. And if a court throws out Cordray's appointment, there could be even more questions about the Bureau's authority and its rules on everything from prepaid debit cards to foreclosure. All of the political and legal challenges to the CFPB have left consumers confused. John Brown is semi-retired, running a plant nursery part-time in Washington State. He's checked out the Bureau's website and liked what he saw. He doesn't like all the controversy over Richard Cordray's appointment, which he thinks is mainly political.
But a challenge to an appointment like that should be specific. It shouldn't just be, well, I don't like him. I think he's philosophically in the wrong pew.
Brown says regardless of Cordray's philosophy, it would be helpful for consumers to have a full-fledged director at the CFPB. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 43 points today, about 0.3%, closed at 14,676. The NASDAQ was flat, 3269. The S&P 500 flat as well, 1578, the number. AT&T dialed back 5% today after earnings failed to match estimates. Consumer products giant Procter & Gamble washed away nearly 6% after trimming its forecast for growth. Boeing, however, climbed 3% today after reporting better-than-expected profits and earnings. Tank and jetmaker General Dynamics up nearly 7%. Yum! Brands, and that does actually have an exclamation point in it, that yum. It served up 7% today as it beat forecast crediting new menu items at Taco Bell. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the House Committee on Energy and Commerce holds a hearing on the nation's prescription drug supply chain. In New York City, the first round of the NFL draft takes place. And how many half-calf extra hot soy lattes are in your budget? Starbucks hopes a lot. The company releases quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Parts of the Midwest are in the middle of some serious flooding right now. High waters have forced evacuations and caused at least 5 deaths. It's some of the same areas that spent last summer in a drought, dreaming of even a little bit of rain. So we thought we'd get on the phone with Ken Lennox again. He's a rancher out in Rolla, Missouri, a bit inland from a lot of the flooding on the big rivers there. Mr. Lennox, good to talk to you again.
Yes, good to hear from you.
Seems to me every time I call you, I ask this question, but how's the weather?
Well, the sun's shining right now, and it's not too bad, but it was overcast and drizzling a little, and we even had a snow shower this morning.
Wow. Snow? You know it's April, right?
I'm not sure the weather knows it.
Have you had too much rain? I mean, is that a possibility for you? Can that happen?
I wouldn't say too much. We're getting about 1.5 to 2 inches every week to 10 days, and the grass is just doing fantastic. But anyway, yeah, everything's growing good.
The first time we talked to you, it was all about drought and what a problem that is. I imagine flooding and too much water is a whole different set of problems.
Well, both of them bring problems, but I'd rather have the too much is not enough. The creeks that go through me, there's one big one, and it'll get out of its banks by, 8-10 foot a lot of times.
Hmm.
We have not seen that in 3 years. I don't think it's been out in the bottoms.
How much of this grass that's growing now are you going to be able to save, or is that not the way it works? I mean, the cattle are just going to eat that stuff, and it's going to be gone in a couple of months, right?
Yeah, that's true. But if you have the proper, you know, nutrition in the ground, we can grow grass virtually all year long. Not in January and February, of course, but you stockpile stuff for that.
Yeah. Hey, can you see the cattle getting heavier now? Are they fattening up? Can you tell?
Oh, yes. The calves that I'm going to sell in the first part of June, they're putting on probably 3 pounds a day right now.
Wow.
You can just almost see them growing. It's just beautiful.
Is it all grass that they're eating, or are they still nursing from their mothers?
Oh, they're still nursing. Yeah, they've got milk faces all the way up to their eyeballs.
Tell me what that is. I don't know what that is.
Well, when they nurse, the TV commercial where the guy gets, or the gal gets the milk lip, you know?
Yeah.
All right, this is literally milk all over their face.
Oh, man.
Yeah, they're getting a lot. The cows have flushed up.
That's,
you know, from the real good grass over just the dry hay through the winter.
Yeah.
Now they're given twice as much milk as they were back a month ago.
Wow. Ken Lennox in Rolla, Missouri. He's our rancher out there. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
While we wait for the House and Senate to make up their minds on immigration reform, they've been celebrating one particular group of immigrants in the UK this past week. That's not to say there isn't tension over there about newcomers to British soil, but if you go back a ways, all right, a long ways back, you find the Huguenots, or as the Brits say, the Huguenots, French Protestants who, if history is a guide, have been some of England's most successful arrivals. From London, here's Stephen Beard.
The bells of Christchurch, Spitalfields in East London. Back in the 18th century, they served as a giant alarm clock. At 5:45 in the morning, 6 days a week, the bells woke the Huguenot silk weavers who'd settled here and sent them scurrying to their looms. Work and religion interwoven in the fabric of their lives.
They were industrious, they had the Protestant work ethic, they were thrifty, conscientious, family-orientated.
And numerous, 50,000 of them arrived in London when England's total population was just 5 million. Charlie de Vett is a Huguenot descendant who lives just around the corner from Christchurch. She says the Protestant Huguenots who were fleeing persecution in 17th century Catholic France gave birth to Britain's silk industry.
Often people say they were the first refugees, and many people say they were the ideal refugees. They would work longer, harder, better. So the Protestant work ethic is really all about doing your job 110% and more.
Would you like to gather round, please? Gather round! Now we're going on the Spitalfields Weavers Walk to commemorate the Huguenot weavers.
This guided tour was part of the first Huguenot festival. An exhibition in Spitalfields Market thronged with people proudly claiming a connection with one of Britain's most successful immigrant groups.
Well, I'm an 11th generation Huguenot.
Stan Rondo, a retired printer, was delighted when he discovered his Huguenot roots.
Yes, it's certainly given me something to sort of crow about, as it were. You know, I've done a hell of a lot of research, and I've even written a little book, which I've called The Rondos of Spitalfields, an everyday story of Huguenot folk. It's not bad, is it?
And there was 83-year-old Beryl Bugler.
I'm a Huguenot from the Boglers. Came over in 1568, apparently.
How do you feel about that Huguenot connection?
I think it's splendid. My father always taught me to be very proud of it.
The most popular stand at the exhibition offered to trace visitors' family trees.
What was the name?
Dyett, D-Y-E.
And his first name, sorry.
Although Julie Dyett was not sure her father would be thrilled to discover a French family connection.
I think my dad would be a bit upset because all he kept saying was, I hate garlic. Don't give me anything with garlic.
Don't like the French.
No.
Given the ancient hostility between the English and the French, it seems extraordinary that so many French people could arrive here in the 17th century, settle down and prosper. But they were fellow Protestants, and they quickly won respect, says TV historian and local resident Dan Cruikshank.
Here are people who come in extremely difficult circumstances, through intelligent and skilled created industry, set a model for hard work, and hard work in a righteous and godly manner.
Within a decade of arriving, Huguenots were involved in setting up England's first central bank, and they swiftly spread into many other businesses, helping to fuel the Industrial Revolution. As so often with immigration, the native country's loss was the host country's gain. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
To the American flying public, our condolences. This is week one of the sequester hitting the not-so-friendly skies. Air traffic controllers from JFK to LAX have begun their furloughs, making for long and painful delays, especially flying into and out of the big East Coast airports around New York City. Steve Abraham's been an air traffic controller at Kennedy Airport in New York for 23 years. We got him today on his first furlough day. Mr. Abraham, good to have you with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
What would you ordinarily be doing right about now?
I would be just about to leave work after having been there since 5:30 this morning.
And what's the workday for an air traffic controller at Kennedy Airport these days?
My shift today would have been from 5:30 to 1:30 today. Not as busy for us in the morning as it is during the afternoon, but things are definitely different now because there are fewer of us there.
Talk to me for a second about this furlough. First of all, how much of a pay cut is it for you?
10%. I lose one day of work every 2 weeks.
That's not a small pay cut.
No, it's pretty significant. And for me, I guess the shock is my wife lost her job as of the 15th of March. So it's going to be an interesting summer.
Yeah, I bet. So my mother-in-law was coming back from LAX on Sunday. Plane was 3 hours late, she was told, because of air traffic control delays. This is, it's not unlike kind of a blizzard hitting, right?
You know, in New York, which, you know, obviously I can speak to because I was there Sunday, we had perfect weather and ran 2.5 to 3 hour delays, which are delays we would see on a horrible weather day.
How does that make you feel as a guy who does this professionally?
It's incredibly frustrating. It's no fun being the political football.
Yeah. You've been there 23 years. You could retire and be done with this and say, you know what, Congress, the heck with you.
Yeah, I could. But I have 3 kids to put through college. And
the
fiscal
you,
reality of that means that's not happening.
Yeah. Is your job easier now than it used to be? I mean, is technology catching up in the air traffic control system? I mean, we've heard lots about how antiquated it is.
You know, I think for the early part of my career, the FAA put all their eggs in a basket to try and introduce a system that would eliminate the need for so many air traffic controllers. And they realized that didn't work.
How many airplanes do you touch figuratively on a given day?
I would say a busy hour at Kennedy is 100. 8 hours, I don't know, 500, 600, 700.
Yeah. Is there going to come a point, since we were talking about technology, where there will be fewer people in control towers and radar approaches and all of that stuff so that you guys might not be as necessary as you are now?
I don't think the technology exists today for that to happen. There may be the technology in the future. I guess I would put it this way. you know, trying to separate airplanes in a two-dimensional environment, going from the ramp to a runway, everybody wants to be number one.
Yeah.
So add a three-dimensional environment and increase the speed from 10 miles an hour to 500. I don't think we're there yet.
When you fly, are you always kind of looking out the window, wondering what the guys on the ground are telling the pilots?
No, I have I have complete faith in my coworkers.
Steve Abraham, he's an air traffic controller at Kennedy Airport in New York City. Today's his furlough day. Mr. Abraham, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note on the way out, this week's sign, I believe, that the apocalypse is upon us. I honestly don't know how I missed this, but somehow I did. It seems just because fast food isn't already convenient enough, you can now get it delivered. I learned today Burger King franchises in Chicago, San Francisco, and here in Los Angeles are going to start delivering Whoppers and fries and all the rest because, to steal a line from one of our producers here, a microwaved $2 hamburger just ain't enough, people. Now you can get it cold and on your doorstep, too. How about them apples? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 43 points, 0.3%. Come on, seriously, delivered fast food? The NASDAQ was flat, finished right where it started. The S&P 500 flat as well. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.